Then she added, "Let me show you around." The rooms of the house were disorganized with piles of books and toys and tilting lampshades. Carol Castleman didn't seem to care or to feel the need to apologize. The baby slept in her parents' room, and I was taken up there, knowing that I was about to enter the place where Castleman lay each night with his wife. The bed was made, though clearly in a hurry, and beside it was a white wicker bassinet. On one of the night tables was a scattering of walnuts. Joe came out of the bathroom and stood in the doorway, now fully dressed. His hair was wet and pushed back off his face, and his tie was knotted. From the record player, a dreamy, tropical female voice sang, "Here am I, your special island. Come away, come away." "Carol," he said, "is the tour over? We should get going." His wife took his arm, and in that frozen pose they appeared to be a clean, presentable young faculty couple going out for the night. They clearly received something from each other, a reciprocity that was founded on things I couldn't even imagine, for he was so handsome, and she so shrunken and ordinary. I thought of my own parents, who were as remote as two stalactites hanging side by side in the same cave, never touching in public. My father in his dark suits that smelled leafy and masculine. My mother in her dresses with patterns that gave them the appearance of tablecloths. My parents had separate beds made of dark shellacked wood, and once, after she'd had a lot to drink at a dinner party, my charity-addled mother swept into my room late at night and confided that my father had recently been rough with her in a marital way. I only understood this much later, though simply the idea of it was awful. My big, impersonal corporate father roughing up my slender, tablecloth-wearing mother as he mounted her in one of their high twin beds. Here in the presence of this husband and wife who were not my parents, and who lived in a world much more complicated than mine, I felt retarded and slack-jawed. I'd called Fanny honey, but I hadn't meant it at all. The nucleus of attraction was the baby's father, a man who ate walnuts and read James Joyce aloud to his students. "Goodbye now," the Castlemans called as they left, leaving telephone numbers and bottles and clean diapers behind. "Goodbye," they sang as they headed into the night air to a faculty dinner party. When they were gone, I gathered up the loose slack of baby and explored the bedroom in depth. Here were the clues to this man. All the evidence I'd ever need. Here in the closet were his shoes, lined up and worn, and here on the dresser was a bottle of his aftershave. Then on a table, I saw a copy of Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, with my professor's name on the flyleaf. Joseph Castleman, he'd written with big flourishes. Columbia University, 1948. As though he was guaranteed to be famous someday, and to excite someone who would eventually open this book and come upon his name. By 1956, of course, he still wasn't famous. But the signature excited me anyway, and I ran a finger along it, tracing the curlicues. Then I put the book down and sat on his side of the bed, laying the baby beside me. I picked up some walnut shells, letting them sift through my fingers, and for a moment, Fanny and I regarded each other coolly. "Hello, you," I said. "I'm falling in love with your daddy, and I'd really like to go to bed with him." In a final burst of nerve, I sprang up and opened the night table drawer. It was as though I needed to find out what it meant to be a wife, to have a life spent beside a man. And sure enough, I found something. A white plastic diaphragm case nestled against a tube of the cream that had to be squirted in along with it, as well as an applicator, all of it making me uneasy, forcing me to imagine the wife of my professor sliding plastic and potions into a deep slot in her body, preparing herself for him. There was a dental pick with a rubber tip in the drawer, too, and a single walnut. I picked up the walnut and looked at it. A red heart had been painted on it, and beneath it were the words, "See, I love you true. J." The walnut was more disturbing than a diaphragm. A diaphragm was a necessary impersonal device, the sort of thing that Smith girls obtained by taking the bus to Springfield and visiting an old female gynecologist from Vilna who barely spoke English and asked few questions. But the inscribed walnut was much more intimate, and therefore somehow perverse. It even looked female, I thought, observing the lips of the nut and the grooves in the shell and the cold silk of the bumpy surface with its red-painted heart. I placed the nut back in the drawer and turned my attention to Fanny, who was suddenly crying and in need of something. A bottle? A change? Who the hell knew? Her crying was an irritant, sand in the pants, and I couldn't understand the universal fetish surrounding babies. Why they were the prize I would supposedly desire in a couple of years. I picked the baby up and held her, ineffectually shushing and rocking her. I had no power here, no authority, not even the secret kind like that of a newly sexual girl with a diaphragm buried deep inside her. Still, though, when the Castlemans returned later, I pathetically tried to make Joe more aware of me. He thanked me and paid me and even offered to give me a lift back to Northrop House, but when I said that I'd be fine on my own, he didn't insist. Instead, he seemed relieved to return to the quiet disorder of his dim house and the now unconscious baby in the bassinet, and I was relieved too, for what would we have talked about? How would we have survived the awkwardness as we sat on the cold, bouncy front seat of his car, heading for my dormitory? A place that I didn't want to be. Where did I want to be? Not there. But not here either, living life as a sleep-starved faculty wife and envious of the way my husband simply wandered in and out of our house whenever he chose. So I wandered out of their house on my own too, trying to give the appearance of independence instead of loneliness. The next morning, returning to my library carol, I wrote about a small, furtive faculty wife about to go out with her husband for the evening, walking down a flight of stairs with her baby over her shoulder, the woman's hand inside the baby's sleeper like a puppeteer at work, imagining that she might be able to control her child for years to come. The mother trades the shadows and smells of her faculty house for the cold night air and a brisk walk with her husband toward another house, where all the lights are on, and music is playing, and faculty couples stand in hopeful clusters. When I was done, I tried to write from the point of view of the husband, including his thoughts as he stood beside his wife, his hand on her elbow as though women might need help navigating any new living room they entered. But something stopped me. I didn't really know what men thought or how they thought. Couldn't imagine what powered them, what steered them, and so I decided not to try. Several days later, after I'd handed in my writing exercise, Castleman asked me to come see him during office hours. I climbed the wide stairs of Seely Hall knowing that he'd either praise me as he usually did, or else tell me I'd invaded his privacy by writing this piece, which the class would read. When he ushered another girl out and let me in, he sat holding my story in his hand. Finally, he leaned forward and said, "Miss Ames, I want you to listen to me. I've already told you that your work is good, but I'm not sure that I got through to you. The way you probably see it, my class is just like any of the others, French or Renaissance art or whatever it is you're taking this semester. You'll be very happy to get an A, and that will be that. But I guess I feel it's important for you to understand that you can really do something with this, if you choose to." "What do you mean?" I asked. "Well, you could probably expand it and sell it as a short story, for instance, and then keep writing more of them and sell those too. Maybe not to the very top places, God knows how they decide who to let in, but certainly to some of the better small literary magazines, and you might even decide to write a novel," he went on. "Why?" I said. "Why? Why would I want to do that? What's the point?" I thought of Elaine Moselle pulling me aside in the alcove. Castleman looked at me. "I don't know," he said, shrugging. "Because you're good. because you have something to say. Plenty of writers have only one or the other, but not both. And it's always interesting when the world gets to see things from a woman's perspective. We're so accustomed to getting the man's view. Whenever we get a chance to see through the eyes of a female, it's refreshing. Elaine Moselle didn't write like a woman usually did. She wrote with big, sweeping arcs and lists and the assumption of authority. And because of all this, she seemed greedy, inappropriate, not female at all. All of my characters so far had been girls or women, and the tone of my writing was quiet and observant, almost cat-like. Women would want to read my writing, I thought, not men. Maybe Castleman was right. In several years, I could publish a perfectly decent first novel, a coming-of-age story with a title like Summer at the Shore, and I might be asked to give an alumni reading at Smith. The girls in the audience would nod in recognition, while the few men present would drum their fingers and wish they were somewhere else. The men would long for armored writing, protected writing, writing that was muscle-bound and never ceased flexing itself. Writing that chose to take in the entire world, including the 100-year wars as well as the 10-minute arguments in some suburban couple's avocado-hued kitchen. But Professor Castleman was a man, and he liked my fiction. Personally, I have trouble writing about women authentically, he admitted. It all comes out sounding like men talking. A bad ventriloquist act where you see the guy's mouth moving the whole time. I still can't connect to the hearts of women. To all that feminine mystery and those secrets they keep. Sometimes I just want to shake it out of them. He stopped. It's extremely frustrating to me as a writer, he said. The wall that separates the sexes, that keeps us from getting to know each other's experience. Everyone has to face this, more or less, though some of the best writers seem to find a clever way around it. As for me, I'm afraid I'm extremely limited. Oh, but you aren't, I said quickly. You've never read my work, he said. I've had 2 stories published in my life. You don't know them. I'd like to, I said. You would? Yes, definitely. Castleman moved some papers and books and walnuts around on his desk until he fished up a slim literary magazine called Caryatid, a journal of art and criticism. I'd never heard of it, and probably almost no one else had either. And Castleman seemed both proud and embarrassed as he handed it over to me. You can borrow it if you like, he said. Let me know what you think. I nodded and said I was flattered and that I was sure I'd love it. Then I looked down the table of contents to find the name of his story. There it was. No Milk on Sunday, by J. Castleman. And as I read the name, he slid his chair forward until our knees were touching. I looked up. Shocked that he was so close. Maybe, he said, you could tell me how to make it better. It was the first contact between 2 sets of blind knees, signifying something not quite decided, something still up for grabs. Was this a conversation about writing? He took an index finger and slowly moved it to my lips. Then Castleman's face came forward and suddenly he was kissing me. In this plain little office where piles of ordinary student stories lay unloved. He kissed and kissed me. And though he seemed to want to lick and swallow my talent, my perceptiveness, whatever it was he thought I had, I still felt that of the 2 of us he was the important one, and I was unfinished. He could finish me, I thought. He could provide the things I needed to actually become a whole person. He kept kissing me, but did nothing more. His hands braced my shoulders, not shifting from their mooring. Even untouched, I nearly had an orgasm, and was surprised and then embarrassed by my exaggerated responsiveness. The girl was embarrassed, I thought, a story opening before me. And I felt relieved to be at a literary distance from myself and this man who was holding my shoulders and kissing me, until I felt sure that even if I hadn't been a writer before, I was one now. I told no one in Northrop House, not even my friend Laura. who suspected something was up but didn't push me for specifics. "This has got to be good, am I right?" she said. I simply smiled, preferring to keep the moment to myself, unwrapping it and reimagining it during a history lecture, or when taking a shower in the tin stall with the green rubber curtain, listening to the waterfall of other showers all around me. On the first night that I knew I'd have uninterrupted reading time, I sat in my bed with Caryatid open in my lap. Delicately, carefully, I turned to his story and began to read. I was excited, anticipating something that would only enhance what I already felt about him. My lips moved along with the story as I read, but soon it became apparent that the story was no good. I was confused. How could the story be no good? Yet in the universe of No Milk on Sunday, the women characters spoke in stilted sentences, and the men were clichés of uneducated men, all glowers and stoic unspoken pain. The story was like an imitation of something literary, made by someone who hadn't developed a distinctive voice of his own. Elaine Mazel's farm story had been more authentic, more believably male. Castleman was an actual man. Why couldn't he write like that? What was wrong with him that he couldn't? I closed the journal and put it aside, upset and sorry I'd read it, not having any idea of what to tell him. Maybe, I thought, he would forget he'd given it to me and would never mention it again, and I wouldn't have to go through the unpleasantness of talking to him about it. Maybe, I hoped, it would simply never come up. Wednesday at noon, a note came to me through intercampus mail in an English department envelope, and I snapped it up quickly, moving away from the other girls who were milling around opening letters and bundt cakes sent from home. Dear Miss Ainge, my colleague, Professor Tanaka, who teaches Eastern religions here, has asked me if I would recommend a student who might come in and feed and walk his dog once a week on Friday afternoons. Would you be interested in the job? Sincerely, J. Castleman. The letter, it seemed, was in code, so I immediately wrote back and agreed to walk and feed Professor Tanaka's dog, though I doubted the dog existed. The following day, a key and an address appeared in my mailbox, and on Friday, I walked down a sloping street called Crafts Avenue and let myself into an apartment building with a bakery downstairs. The building smelled of yeast, and when I entered the third-floor apartment with the nameplate that read H. Tanaka, an actual dog began a frenzy of yipping from somewhere inside. It was a dachshund, old, gray-haired, and desperate for company, its spine curving in discreet ridges like a dinosaur's. "Here, boy," I said, as I walked through the barely furnished living room. And even in his arthritic state, the dog began to mount my leg as though he, too, knew why I had come here. In the kitchen I found a can of Beefo for small to medium dogs, poured it into a tin bowl, keeping my head averted from the stink, and watched dispassionately as a dog ate like a wolf. After I took him for a short walk, I went back inside and sat on the rug. The nameless dachshund, sated and happy, lay on his back and exposed his graying stomach to me, his penis sliding from its casing, then retracting. There were a few Japanese prints on the walls above us, women in kimonos serving thimbles of tea, and a series of scenes involving rock pools and nesting cranes. I was sitting in this unfamiliar, calm room, looking around me, waiting, when the bell rang. "Who is it?" I asked through the intercom. "Joe," he said. So he was Joe now. That was new. I let him in quickly. "Hello," he said. And he walked past me, putting down his books and papers and folding his coat over the back of a chair. "Is the dog behaving himself?" he asked. "The dog is fine," I said. I wasn't even sure he was real. "Oh, he's definitely real," Joe said. "I know. He mated with my leg." Joe smiled. "So, pretty soon we should be seeing little half-dog, half-leg creatures running around the apartment, am I right?" "Right," I said. Now he stood still and looked at me. "Miss Ames, I mean, Joan, what should we do with you? Pickle me?" I said. He stepped forward and then he held me in his arms, kissing my hair and neck. "So, can we go to bed, please?" he asked. Professor H. Tanaka's bedroom was much like the living room, with just a few prints on the walls and a simple bed. A gray light filtered in through the paper shade, enough to reveal the basic image of Joe as he stripped off his clothes. He was good-looking, tightly muscular. There was a scar on his foot, pink and shiny, the tissue pulled tight. A bullet hole, I assumed, the source of his slight limp, and I imagined him as a Korean War hero, though, later, of course, I'd learn how he'd accidentally shot himself in training camp. When he touched me, his skin was cold as a seal's. In bed, with my own clothes gone, my nipples seemed to turn and tighten, and I resisted the impulse to cross my arms and cover myself. My breasts felt excessive, a detail that men generally liked, though it embarrassed me. I saw him look at my breasts, and at that seemingly arbitrary patch of pubic hair. But I tried to imagine I was with him by the side of a Japanese rock pool, and that what we were about to do now would be as gracefully executed as a tea ceremony. I held his penis in my hand, observing it for an uninterrupted moment. It was my first penis, and it seemed so optimistic in a way, much more so than he was. It was agreeable, ready, unconscious of the possibility of failure. I lay back against the pillow and watched him snap on a Trojan which made a single twang like a banjo string. And then I let him push into me, hoping that in some larger way my presence here helped him. I knew I was certainly helping myself, lifting above the flocks of girls with their long plaid skirts swishing. Joe was quickly breaking a sweat, and his ice-cold feet curled around mine, holding on like those of some primitive tree-dweller. The way he shoved into me was very painful, and this surprised me, as though his sensitivity and love of books might have some bearing on the level of pain he would inflict when he deflowered a Smith girl. I thought again of his knees in gray wool trousers, and now his bare knees, those dusty, exposed knobs where the skin was pulled tight, the calves below flexing and releasing. I wrapped my legs around him, and I seemed to be holding him by mechanical means. I'd never known my legs were this strong. A while later, I wanted to sleep, but Joe didn't or couldn't. "Oh, don't worry about me. I never sleep," he told me. "It's one of the most basic facts about me." "One of the only facts I know," I said. "I'll tell you anything you want," he said, and waited for me to ask. I had no idea of what I wanted, and so I posed some simple questions about his upbringing, Brooklyn, Jewish, fatherless, his education, Columbia University, BA, MA, his military history, Korean War, briefly, self-inflicted shrapnel sending him home before combat, his marriage, bad, to a woman grown shrill, whose most significant crime was that, since the baby was born, she no longer wanted to have sex. She refused him, he said, turning away from him again and again. "Do you have any idea of what that does to a man?" he asked me, and I had to say that no, I didn't. His politics, unoriginal, thrilled when Welch stuck it to McCarthy, stirred by Brown versus Board of Education, especially as he had a couple of close Negro friends in the city. His favorite moments, listening to Mark Van Doren lecture at Columbia, and his outlook on life, melancholic, like most writers. After I had exhausted the interview, we were silent for a while, until suddenly he said, "Oh, now I want to ask you something." "Go ahead," I said, thinking that he was going to ask me all about myself, and that I'd have to tell him the mundane details of being a privileged girl growing up in New York City. The Brearley School, my formal dance class, my parents' puzzling coldness, the money that was scattered around me like an uninteresting garnish. And I'd also have to tell him of my insecurities, my percolating political sympathies, my desire not to be insubstantial. I dreaded having to talk to him about myself, and yet I was also relieved. So this was what it meant to be with a man. He told you things that he cared about. Then you told him things you cared about. And you each responded with outrage or sympathy at appropriate points in the other person's story. It was like having a friend, a strange mirror version of yourself, though with an entirely different anatomy and set of memories. When you were both done talking, you felt as though you'd been given extraordinary access into each other's inner workings and storehouses of experience. But instead, he asked me, "So what did you think of my story?" His story. Oh, God. For a moment, I had no idea what to say. I was confused and flustered and said nothing at all. "Did you read it yet?" he persisted. I nodded, trying to form some sort of emergency response as quickly as I could. "Yes," I said brightly. "Just last night, I was going to tell you." Then I waited a second. "I loved it," I told him. It was easy to say that. "You did?" he said. He propped his head up on one elbow. "You didn't think the ending was too abrupt? The part where he gives her the scarf and then walks away?" "No," I said. "Not at all. It was the gesture of the scarf that counted, wasn't it?" I thought it was perfect. But I knew it wasn't perfect. It was all wrong. It was forced. "You really mean it?" he asked me. "Of course. I was going to tell you, but you got there first." "Well, that's just wonderful," he said, smiling. "Now you've really made my day, Joni." I let out a quiet breath. The praise had made him happy and peaceful, the way sex was supposed to do. Eventually, he said it was time to go. He had to stop off at the State Street Market to bring home a sack of flour his wife had requested, and he also had to pick up some baby formula for his daughter. Flour and formula. These were the paraphernalia of a life that had nothing in common with mine. We stood and dressed, turned shyly away from each other. "Joe," I said, trying out the plain single syllable. He looked at me. "What do you think is going to happen?" I asked him. He didn't answer for a second, and then he said, "How can I possibly know? We'll have to wait and see, I guess." A little while later, as I walked by myself back to campus in the deepening afternoon, past the hardware store and the second-hand bookshop and the grand facade of the Academy of Music, I wondered whether he might ever love me and how I might rush that love into existence. As it would turn out, we soon developed a routine, meeting once a week when I walked and fed Professor Tanaka's dachshund. Walking the dog became a euphemism. "The dog is very hungry today," he would tell me as he flipped up the hem of my dress and touched me with the tip of a finger. I had myself fitted for a diaphragm in the dim office of the Lithuanian female doctor in Springfield. One day when we lay in Professor Tanaka's bed, Joe handed me something wrapped in tissue paper and a ribbon. I opened it and saw that it was a walnut, and that on the side he had written something in red paint with a fine brush. "To Jay," it read. "In awe. J." I held it for a moment, trying to rearrange my disappointment into something else. Of course he had no way of knowing that I'd gone through his wife's drawer and seen the almost identical walnut he had given to her. I didn't like eating walnuts. Sometimes you got some shell with the meat and you ended up trying to pull flecks of it off your tongue like tobacco leaves. And the taste was too dark and somehow wrong, as though you were eating bits of cork floating in a glass of wine. Joe had said he liked walnuts for all of these reasons. They were a complicated nut, with all those knobs and curves in them. A walnut left an oily trail behind after you had eaten it, an aftertaste that Joe also liked. He liked the taste of women, too, he had said once in Professor Tanaka's bed. He liked the first moment when he could dip down and taste me, even though I was embarrassed in the beginning and unable to relax with his head clenched in the grasp of my legs. All I could think about was what he was tasting, the mix of salt and talc and who knew what else. Nothing could hide a woman's taste, thank God, he'd said. A walnut, too, could always be detected when it was baked into a cookie or when its oil was used in a salad. There was a sweet, dark taste released, with the hint of decomposition, like something found on the floor of a forest. I put the walnut on the bureau in my room in Northrop House, leaving it there among the crisscross spray of bobby pins and the jumbo tub of cold cream. Weeks passed and his walnut stayed on the bureau. I'd almost forgotten it was there until the day when I came home from my art history class on Holbein and Dürer and opened the door of my room to find Joe's wife sitting on the bed, waiting for me. Carol Castleman stood up when I came in. "Can I help you?" I asked, and I thought for an insane moment that Joe was dead and that his wife had come here to break it to me, as though I would be the truly bereaved one, not her. "Can you help me? You know why I'm here," Mrs. Castleman said. She wore a camel hair jacket and a creased skirt. She was small, frantic, unspooling. "I let you into my house," she continued, her body starting to fibrillate. "I trusted you with my baby, okay? And this is what you do? You act so young and adorable, but you have a lot of nerve." "Who told you this?" I asked miserably. Carol Castleman didn't say anything. She just held up her hand and opened it slightly. Inside was the walnut, the one that Joe had given to me. Proof. Elsewhere in Northrop House, girls were getting ready for dinner. From downstairs, the smell of Yorkshire pudding was lifting through the building, eggy and thick and nourishing, an imitation of a previous life at home. A life in the womb. A life in which people took care of us and we didn't have to do a thing for ourselves. I wanted to eat that consoling food right now, to dig into a plate pooled with roast beef juices while hearing dinner table stories about comically bad dates with Yale men. But instead I was here, facing Joe's furious wife, who was holding a walnut in her hand.
"So tell me about it," Carol Castleman said.
"I can't," I said, starting to cry. She let me cry for a little while, watching me the whole time, irritated. And then finally, when she couldn't take it any longer, she said, "Tell me."
"I'm not a bad person, Mrs. Castleman," I tried.
And what I really meant was, you see, I'm not actually much of a person yet at all.
"You little bitch," said Carol Castleman. "You smithy bitch with your stories. I've read those stories, and you want to know something? They're not so terrific. I don't know what the hell he goes on and on about them for. You'd think they were written by James fucking Joyce."
And then Joe's wife drew back her hand and hurled the walnut. It shot straight at me, but there was no time to shout or move out of the way. When it struck me, it was with a hard shock. One solid bop in the middle of my forehead, making a sound like a cobbler's hammer, and for a suspended moment I wobbled before falling to the floor. I was vaguely aware of the sound of feet galloping toward me down the hall, and then the appearance of a ring of girls' faces suspended above me, each one wearing an open-mouthed expression, like a group of carolers in action. Someone had curlers on, another one had a pencil behind her ear. Everyone began speaking in overlapping voices, yet no one seemed to know what to do. Somewhere in the background, Carol Castleman was weeping and telling the room full of girls that her life had been destroyed. But all I could think about now, as I lay on the rug with a lump rising in the center of my forehead, was the fact that my own life had finally begun.
Chapter 3. The Helsinki-Vantaa Airport is like every other airport in the world, only a little blonder. Not blonde like Sweden or Norway, those cool albino hotbeds, but blonde enough in patches to make any American take notice. The Finns have a Slavic darkness running right through them. But still, there are plenty of fair heads bobbing in this tiny, lovely northern country. I couldn't help but think this as Joe and I and the rest of our party moved through the airport in a whirl of Finns, some of them taking pictures, some asking questions, all of them wanting something from him. A touch, a word, a gently tired smile, as though his talent might rub off in these casual moments, imparting a little bit of a glow to them, which they would return by giving him a touch of their own brand of Scandinavian goldenness. They were blonde and attractive, so many of these Finns, and the rest of them were simply noble and heroic-looking, like heads carved on Viking ships. And he was a small 71-year-old, formerly handsome and dark-haired Jewish man from Brooklyn. But somehow, the love fest between him and them was boundless, continuing all the way through the airport corridor, which struck me as being as long as a smorgasbord table. "Love me," he seemed to say to them through his glazed and flight-worn eyes. "Yes, we will love you, Mr. Josef Castleman," the Finnish people seemed to reply, "if you will love us back." And what was not to love? They had chosen him, hadn't they? The elderly men who comprised the Finnish Academy of Letters, and the younger ones, too. The hipsters who were probably only in their 60s. Joe seemed not to notice anything, so much was he getting a kick out of the pomp of his arrival. This was what he had been waiting for. Always. To step off an airplane and be met like the Beatles landing in America. It would have been even better for him if, like the Beatles, he could have descended one of those shaky tin stairways onto an airstrip, his thin hair whipping around his head, waving his arm to the adoring people below. But instead, we had stepped from the plane into one of those carpeted accordion tunnels and then wound up in the early morning terminal outside the city limits. A clean white space with eerie department store chimes playing and an amplified, soothing, generic female Euro voice speaking incomprehensibly about departing and arriving flights and then, inexplicably in English, asking would Mr. Kojosti Huninen please meet his party at the baggage carousel. Going past the duty-free shops and kiosks and backlit wall photos of the splendors of Finland, Joe was friendly and charming to the members of the press who approached him, and the handful of government representatives with their official clip-on badges that featured tiny images of their own Scandinavian selves. But I knew he was barely listening to anything they said in their careful English. He was high right now. He was ecstatic. I thought of Joe's beginnings spent in the female universe of that Brooklyn apartment. His first bad marriage and its noisy end. His second long marriage, and Joe's professional ascendance during it. Then the kids. Oh, the kids. I hadn't known what it would be like to have a household populated by children. I'd had stirrings toward babies, but fear as well. My desire to have a baby was swaddled in the need to make Joe happy. I couldn't separate them. I peered into an imaginary carriage and saw Joe's oversized head poking out from beneath the blanket. But when they were born, they became themselves, not him. Each child revealed his or own specifics. Susanna, our first, was given extra attention like all firstborns. She would come into the kitchen where I'd be frying a lamb chop in a pan and she'd announce, "Me help!" knowing that the food was for Joe, who was busy in the bedroom. "All right, my girl, you help," I'd say. And Susanna would spear the chop in the hot pan and plunk it down on a plate, adorning it with crumpled pieces of paper meant to look like flowers. Then she'd carry it carefully down the hall and kick Joe's door a few times in lieu of knocking. I'd hear murmuring between them, a father's distracted words, a daughter's quivering entreaties to, "Look at the plate, Daddy, look!" And then a father's quick change of gears, his voice raising up in praise and saving the day. Me, she loved. Him, she adored. I never minded this, and when she and I were together I felt completely relaxed, gratified by her smell,
her smooth skin, her feverish excitement at all new things. If she'd had a tail, it would have been continually thumping. When I was unavailable to her, when I was otherwise engaged, which was often, and had to leave her with a babysitter, her face would take on a tragic cast that would almost kill me. Her sister Alice wound up sturdy and athletic and more independent. She wasn't good-looking like her sister, merely healthy-looking. Her body small and tight like Joe's had once been, her hair light brown and cut close to the head in Roman boy fashion. When Alice became a teenager, her lesbianism finally presented itself. After many telegraphic years of crushes on favorite young ingenue-type teachers and a bedroom papered over with the witchy-haired women of rock and tennis Amazons with hard brown thighs packed incongruously into little white dresses. And when it did present itself, I was relieved to hear it said aloud, though Joe seemed startled and personally hurt. "I like girls," she burst out to us one night, out of nowhere, in the kitchen. "What?" said Joe, who'd been at the table deep in the newspaper. "I like girls," Alice continued bravely. "That way. You know." The refrigerator suddenly stirred and clicked and began to manufacture ice cubes, as if to fill the awful silence. "Oh," said Joe, staying pinned to his chair. My heart was immediately racing, but I walked over to Alice and hugged her. I told her I was glad she'd said something, and I asked her if there was someone in particular she liked. "Yes," she said, but the girl had been horrible to her. We talked politely about it for a minute or two, and then she slipped off to her bedroom. "It's not about you," I said to Joe that night in bed, as we furiously whispered back and forth. This would be a theme of our conversations about the children. "Yes, I'm aware of that," Joe said. "That's my point." "So what are you saying? You want to be the centerpiece of your daughter's sexuality?" "No," he'd said. "Not at all." "You're a mother. You can't understand what I might feel about this." "Oh, that's a good one," I'd said, wanting him to believe that mothers knew everything, that we were the omniscient narrators of our family's lives. David, the youngest, the troubled one, seemed incapable of finding a life for himself. Joe and I were always holding our breath and hoping everything would work out for him, but this was magical thinking. Very little would work out for David. That had become increasingly clear, and his life was up for grabs. But still we loved him. We loved them all, Joe and I, though not quite together. The children received two separate channels of love. One from me, a reasonably steady flow, and one from their father whenever he thought of it, whenever he could manage to turn away from himself. He was distracted so much of the time, caught up in the details of his professional life and all the accolades that kept accumulating like inches of snowfall. The children and I simply watched as Joe's career grew and grew. And now, finally, he had made it all the way to Finland. The country was bafflingly sweet and bracing and fresh. Once a year it was roughly roused from its slumber. "Wake up, wake up, an important person is a-comin'." As we kept walking through the airport with our publishing entourage, I realized that if I wanted to, I could easily disappear into the wilds of this country and never return. I wouldn't stand out in Finland with my fair hair and pale skin. I would fit right in, and they would think I was one of them. How wonderful to be able to begin a bewildering new life here. Instead of returning in a week to the house in Wethermill, New York, with my giant baby of a husband, my genius, my very own winner of the Helsinki Prize. "Joe," I said, "look to the left. They're trying to take your picture." He turned obediently, and there was a rapid flutter of stutter whirring, and he held himself a little more stiffly and grandly. Tomorrow the photographs would appear in newspapers, showing this old American Jewish man squinting into the lights,
revealing his awkward humanness, his exhaustion from air travel mixed with the vanity that had long propelled him through airports and the world. Outside the terminal, a limousine waited for us, as dark as its driver was fair, and the first strike of frozen air made me feel as though my lungs would collapse as we quickly slipped from building to car. It was the beautiful fall foliage time of year here that the Finns called Ruska, with its changing flipbook of brooding colors. Only late autumn, and yet Joe and I were both shocked by the cold. It was unmanageable, I thought, and I imagined a society in which people went skittering from house to car to office and back to car to house, and then the day was done. There wasn't much sunlight left in this day, though right now the sky seemed hugely bright and endless. The sunlight in Finland tricked you into believing it would last. You couldn't imagine that it would shut itself off with such grim finality, even before the enzymes in your stomach had barely started to break down the components of your lunch. The car ferried us gently past the waterfront and the glass fronts of shops on the boulevard called Mannerheim that sold delicate things wrapped in foil and crinkled paper, and past sudden long stretches of bridge rail. We'd been to Finland once before over the course of our marriage, back in the 1980s, when Joe had been invited to give a reading as part of the 500th anniversary celebration of the Finnish book, and it had seemed to me at the time that the entire country was shot through with ice. I liked Finland for its absence of overt rage or street crime. This wasn't the United States. This wasn't Spain. It was calm here and moody. A gorgeous, elegant place with slightly off-kilter serotonin levels. A depressed country. This was an easy diagnosis to make, given the suicide statistics which Scandinavia sometimes tries to deny, just the way Cornell University tries to allay the fears of incoming students' parents about the famous Ithaca Gorge, which, like a harvest ritual each fall, claims the life of a few more hopeless freshmen. "Don't worry," the college brochure should say. "Though some students do in fact leap to their deaths, most prefer keg parties and studying." All of Scandinavia was alluring, with its ice fishing and snow caps. But everyone knew about the legend of ingrained unhappiness among Finns, Norwegians, and Swedes. Their drinking, their mournful baying songs, their muffled darkness smack in the middle of the day. "And here is the Helsinki Opera House, Mr. Castleman," the driver said as our car smoothly went past an enormous building that appeared capable of containing an entire kingdom within its thick walls. "It is where you will go, sir, to receive your award and be feted." "Yes, Joe, you will be feted," I murmured, but he didn't hear. I envisioned us in the opera house, with Joe being honored for a body of work that surely must have puzzled the Finnish people, though apparently they read it anyway. They were a profoundly literate people. The winter was nearly endless. What else could they do but read? "The novels puzzle me, too," he probably wished he could say to them in shaky Finnish, painstakingly accenting every word on the first syllable like the Finns do. His books were populated by unhappy, unfaithful American husbands and their complicated wives. Maybe it would have done Joe's characters some good to have their days shortened, to force the sun to set a little sooner on their miserable marital and extramarital shenanigans. And then, after the ceremony, we'd be eating dinner at a long table in an enormous chilly marble hall. Members of the Finnish Parliament would murmur in his ear, but he wouldn't be intimidated by them, for they weren't royalty. The Nobel Prize, on the other hand, gives you a hefty shot of royalty, seating you beside King Gustav for an evening of awkward conversation. What had the King of Sweden and Lev Bresner talked about that night in Stockholm, the King sitting beside our friend, swathed in robes like a herring in cream? I didn't have a clue. Joe would never have to make such a conversation. He wasn't big enough in scope or darkness. Already it was killing me to be in Helsinki, to watch him encircled by people, to listen to their gravely earnest questions, to hear his answers,
to watch them anoint him with essential oils and declare him the best. I hadn't known for certain before I'd gotten on the airplane in New York that I would leave him. I'd had fantasies over the years, little scenarios in which I said, "Joe, it's over." Or else simply, "Well, guess what? You're on your own now." But none of these had been translated into action. Instead, like most wives, I'd hung on for dear life. But in the past few weeks, it had become too much. It was more than I'd bargained for, and I wouldn't stay much longer. I kept looking at him, absorbing the familiar bump in his nose, the purpled skin of his eyelids, the thin white hair, and recalling that he had once been an angelic young boy, and then an ambitious and handsome young writing instructor, and then a nervy, celebrated novelist who had stayed awake all night and wanted to suck up the entire world and hold it in his lungs for a moment before letting it out. And now he was old, with a humbling bioprosthetic heterograft porcine valve. However you slice it, it's just pig meat. Stuck like a clove into his heart, and pig memories somehow looped into his brain. Happy images of rooting around among old nectarines and tennis shoes. His energies had been funneled in a thousand directions and were now becoming depleted, and wherever he went, there were laurels crunching and rustling beneath him, and twining vines and leaves he could lounge upon, contented. Before long, our car pulled in front of Helsinki's Strand Intercontinental Hotel. Men in uniforms leaped from the hotel in synchrony, appearing untouched by the cold, yanking open the frozen doors of our car, and soon we were inside, our luggage trailing us, the owner and his ecstatic wife springing forward to say hello and to offer Joe their congratulations. Opulent warmth immediately replaced the startle of cold, and the interior smelled to me like the deepest part of a forest in some Scandinavian folktale, perhaps a tale called Young Pavot and the Five Wishes. Light seemed to slant into the lobby, as if through a break in the overarching branches of some enormous trees. Improbably, I smelled pine and sap, and all at once, demented from jet lag, I felt like lying down right here on the dense carpet of the Intercontinental Hotel, proving myself to be the sad, unbalanced wife of the newest winner of the Helsinki Prize. But still, we had to keep going. We traversed the spongy forest floor, going past mahogany walls and long golden hallways, following the spanking clean bellman and his two assistants, all of whom could easily have been brothers in a family in which the children were bred exclusively to service the Finnish hotel industry. Joe was confident now, walking quickly. He was easy in his skin, gliding smoothly by. The fact that he was the outsider, the Brooklyn boy, only added to the peculiar cachet he enjoyed in this alien country. Other than a small cluster of reporters and photographers and his nominal editor, Sylvia Blacker, the rest of the publishing people and Irwin, Joe's sleepy agent of recent years, there didn't seem to be any other Americans in sight. Whenever we were in Europe, we could usually recognize them by their slouch and smile, the way they clutched their beloved copies of the Herald Tribune, or by their too bright clothing, their eagerness to be talked to by other Americans, as though, without the familiar rounded syllables of the heartland, they would become as frightened as lost children. Both of our daughters had offered to accompany us to Finland, but Joe didn't seem to want them there, so they stopped asking. They're used to this by now. "The thing is," Joe said to Susanna, "if you come, I'll feel so guilty about having no time for you. I'll worry about it. It'll distract me. Instead, why don't you and Mark and the boys plan on coming to Wethermill when I get back? We can spend a long weekend here. I'll be 100% available. I'll give myself over to all of you. I'll be your love slave." He had an impish look in his eye, that old man whimsy he'd learned to do well ever since age had caught him and slowed him and damaged his heart. I felt that he would be distracted having the kids there,
but that really his concerns were for himself, not them. He'd won the Helsinki Prize. He took it seriously. He wanted to savor it slowly, carefully, and not have to be distracted by making sure that everyone around him was happy, which in any family is an impossible task. Over the years when he'd won lesser prizes, there they'd been at the banquets and dinners and cocktail parties, his scrubbed children at various stages of childhood and adolescence. I wasn't sure how he felt about their presence, but me, I'd loved having them around me. I'd clung to them when it all got to be too much. To be honest, I'd used them as human shields. There they'd been in their pretty little dresses and David in his monkey suit, strangling under the knot of some green and gold slippery tie from the boys' shop. I'd always had a lot to drink at these celebrations, guzzling down the white wine they offered me, and the champagne and anything else. My children could always see it, could tell the moment when my eyes became swimmy. "Mom!" Susanna once whispered as we stood under a tent at the Academy of Arts and Letters, to which Joe had just been inducted. The wet mouthfuls of poached salmon I'd eaten at the lunch hadn't been enough to absorb the full force of the spirits I'd consumed. I was pickled. I rocked lightly back and forth on my feet, and Susanna, age 13, steadied me with her hand. "Mom," she said a little louder, scandalized, "you're drunk." "A little, honey," I whispered back. "I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry if I'm embarrassing you." "You're not, but let's go somewhere," she said, and I let her steer me away from the Big Top for a while. We walked down to the street there in uppermost Manhattan, where a few taxis loitered and a man stood smoking outside a bodega. We sat on the stoop of a building in our formal clothes, and I drank a bottle of guava nectar that she bought me at the bodega, and tried to sift through the fog so I could return to the festivities. "If you're so miserable," my daughter said delicately, "then why don't you leave him, Mom?" "Oh, my darling girl," I might have said. "What a good question." In her worldview, bad marriages were simply terminated like unwanted pregnancies. She knew nothing about this subculture of women who stayed, women who couldn't logically explain their allegiances, who held tight because it was the thing they felt most comfortable doing, the thing they actually liked. She didn't understand the luxury of the familiar, the known, the same hump of back poking up under the cover in bed, the hair tufting in the ear, the husband. A figure you never strove toward, never worked yourself up over, but simply lived beside season upon season, which started piling up like bricks spread thick with sloppy mortar. A marriage wall would rise up between the two of you, a marriage bed, and you would lie in it gratefully. What I actually said to Susanna was, "Who said I'm miserable?" She looked at me pointedly, silent. "When I get married, I want it to be so easy that everyone will look at us and understand exactly why we ended up with each other," she said. So she married a man who was different, but not, as it would turn out, satisfying. Mark was attractive, built like a whippet with a runner's body, golden fillings of hair on long tan wrists. But the man never read a book unless it was a biography of Jefferson or Franklin or a true story of an Arctic expedition. Fiction was outside his realm, and so in fact was art of any kind. Susanna was lonely. I knew that about her. Could see it among all the other small trophies of unhappiness that she lined up on triumphant display for me, the way children often do, providing an entire museum of disappointments and inviting the parents in, as if to say, "You see? You see how you fucked me up and what it led to? It led to this." My daughter was a woman whose father had disappointed her. She'd made Joe clay pots over the years in art class,
an endless ceramic shower in a prolonged effort to win his attention. She already had his love. Love was easy. Attention was something else entirely. And how could she ever get that? She wasn't a sex partner. She wasn't a colleague. She wasn't a book.